Good afternoon. My name is Kelly, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the DESRIP Q&A conference call. All lines will be placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Jason Helgerson, you may begin your conference.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome everyone. Sorry for a slightly delayed start here, but so this conference call is an operator-assisted one, and our goal here is to try to answer as many questions as we can in the roughly 2 hours we have slotted for this particular conference call. We know that a lot of information has been put out, and while we have been crisscrossing the state holding public hearings, I think we held a total of 6 public hearings in virtually all the areas of the state. There's still a lot of questions that are coming to us about all the documents, people trying to figure out during this, what I call sort of call the education phase of year zero, figure out how the programs work, what kind of relationships need to be created in order to be a participant, particularly in the delivery system reform incentive payment program portion of the waiver. And we are very excited by the degree of interest there is. Just to give folks a sense, there's a couple of things that will be coming here in the very near future. We're in the process of finalizing an FAQ document, frequently asked questions, which we, in the next day or so, plan to post to the website. Hopefully people will find that very helpful. We've been receiving quite a few questions from the field, trying to gather those and organize them in ways that are helpful and hopefully are as straightforward as possible. Also, we are in the process of finalizing 2 procurements that will be going out. 1 procurement is for the independent assessor, vital role over the length of the waiver, but starting initially with being the entity that's responsible for assessing the applications and scoring those applications when they come in. Also, we are putting out a procurement to provide the state, we call the district support team, with additional resources during year zero to really help would-be applicants in actually putting together really strong proposals. I think a key theme here is that our goal here is to try to make sure that would-be applicants have the access to resources above and beyond the planning grants that folks can apply for, but that we can bring some technical assistance to the table to assist you as you draft those put those applications. We really want strong applications from all across the state, ones that will score very high and therefore generate significant project value and benefit to communities across the state. So that just gives you a flavor, a little bit of what to expect here in the very near future in terms of additional important documents. So with that, what I'd like to do is turn it to open it up for questions. That's why we're here, and look forward to any questions that people have on more generally on the MRT waiver amendment itself, or in particular as it relates to delivery system reform incentive payment program. So really, the floor is yours.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one from your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from a line of a participant whose information has not been transcribed. Caller, please state your first and last name. Your line is open.
Ann Corrigan, Medicis.
Hello, Ann. What's your question?
Hi. Can you explain how you're going to value avoidable ED admissions and in this performance project?
Sure. So just to be clear in terms of your question, you mean value them, or do you mean how we're going to
measure
avoidable hospital use? Okay, measure. So what I'll do is I'll turn that over to Greg to talk about the specific measures of avoidable hospital use that we will be using as part of the evaluation of each of the district projects.
Okay, thanks, Jason, and thanks, Ann. Just for everybody, just in terms of resources on the measures, in the documents on the website, I would call everybody's attention to Attachment J of the special terms and conditions of the waiver that's governing this activity. inside Attachment J are the list of projects, and next to the list of projects are all the very specific measures. And we have information about the measure sources as well. To answer this specific question, we will be using 3M's potentially preventable visits and their potentially preventable ED visit algorithm that will be used for measuring that. For measuring potentially avoidable admissions, we will be using PQIs for the adult side and PDIs for the pediatric side. And there's a wealth of information on those measures and how those measures are set up, and there'll be more information coming on the website as well.
All right. Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Andrew Kosky. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. Jason Helgen, this is Andrew Kosky at the Home Care Association of New York State. And again, some of our members that are home care providers are having problems, collaborating with large partners, and I'm wondering if you can offer them any guidance on how they can do that.
Sure. So thanks for the question. Good question. Obviously, we want to encourage collaborations across the entire spectrum of healthcare delivery. Home care providers, very important providers, particularly when it comes to reducing avoidable hospital use. Home care providers, provide sometimes are. And as they say, can really be the glue that holds the care teams together for some of our most complex patients in the Medicaid program. And so it's really important for providers to realize that, acknowledge that, and be inclusive in their development of their performance provider systems to include those kinds of providers. One of the things that I think will help drive this further will be when we provide some clarification in the near future in terms of how long-term care providers fit into the attribution methodology, which we're in the process of working on right now and finalizing. But I think what also will be helpful is when we receive on the 15th of this month, May 15th, we will be receiving these non-binding letters of intent, which I think our goal there is to at least get an initial sense of who's partnering with who and who's working together towards developing performing provider systems across the state. Those forms that we will be receiving, we're going to make those available to the website. So folks can go out and look at the potential partnerships that are being formed in their communities across the state, with the potential being that you could actually reach out yourselves to those would-be partners and talk about what relationships you're potentially interested in trying to forge. As I say, I think that as folks better understand the attribution methodology, partners and providers such as home care agencies are going to be really important. So, Greg, Alan also has something to add on that?
Yes, I would also say that many of you know that we've put Medicaid volume information for the acute care sector up on the website, and a lot of folks have been paying attention to those workbooks to guide network formation in terms of the highest volume Medicaid providers. We are busy at work on putting together a long-term care set of workbooks as well as a set of workbooks for behavioral health. And those we hope to have coming up on the website in the coming weeks. It will likely be following the letters of intent, but I think that will help everyone to understand in each community who the key Medicaid players are in the long-term care and behavioral health sector, and that may also help advance those partnership conversations locally.
All right, so let's move on to the next question.
Your next question comes from the line of a participant whose information has not been transcribed. Caller, please state your first and last name. Your line is open.
Hi. The issue is if there's a stated goal to reduce avoidable hospital use by 25%, if an LTAC were part of a network that had a planned approach to reduce acute care facility use, either by reducing the length of stay or avoiding hospitalizations or readmissions, do those identified savings count to the 25% goal?
The goal here is to reduce avoidable hospital use for Medicaid and dually eligible individuals, and it'll be performance relative to that population that will be utilized. And I think that each of the performing provider systems, each and every year, we will be looking at the population they actually serve within their PPS and look at the degree to which, in terms of serving that population, they're decreasing the rates of each of those avoidable hospital use measures. And with the idea being that each and every year they will close the gap by 10% between their current level performance and the statewide goal for each of those measures. So in a sense, whatever providers are coming together within a PPS, they're going to be expected to reduce that. And, you know, the strategies laid out in terms of, and obviously partnerships that are potentially there between LTACs and you know, hospitals, nursing homes, a wide array of providers who you could imagine working together for that common goal. So I think, you know, within that context, I think each and every community needs to figure out who the right partners are to achieve success, because the end, particularly in years 4 and 5, is a waiver that most of the money that's associated with this program is going to be associated with actually driving down the avoidable hospital use. All right, next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Mary Hassett. Your line is open.
Thank you. My question relates to the letter of intent and the partner list that is to be submitted with that. The question is this: should it include all of the anticipated community-based partner stakeholders in addition to the more traditional providers? And what I mean by that is, in our markets, we believe that organizations like community-based organizations who do work with chronic diseases, even our EMS mobile units, Easter Seals, community centers, and so on, will end up being a very influential part of our success. However, some of those don't have all of the information that's looked for within the format of the provider list. And I realize another provider list will be provided in the final format. So the question is, what are you looking for more specifically in the LOI partner listing?
Excellent question. We'd like that list to be as complete as possible, understanding full well that we're only here in the middle of May and there's still a lot of work to do, a lot of relationships to be built. But I think what you're talking about and how you're viewing the situation is completely accurate, in the sense that a lot of these community-based organizations are really essential to addressing the social determinants of health that are really stand in the way of really achieving some of these healthcare metrics like reductions in avoidable hospital use. So to the extent you can, include those potential partners on that list, to the extent to which they're a vital part of that network, which we think they absolutely should be. And please do include them. We know that, you know, some of the categories that are there, like NPI number, things like that, aren't appropriate if you're not a traditional healthcare provider. But definitely including the information that is relevant to that type of provider in the form would be very helpful for us. And I think helpful for the broader community to give a sense of who it is that you're really partnering with.
So, okay, thank you. And I have one second question. Would you like me to hold it, or may I ask that now?
Why not? Go ahead.
Okay, the second question relates to home health agencies. Am I correct that the home health agencies may be distributed across a number, in other words, be in duplicative PPSs? Maybe not in the same job.
Sure. The answer is yes, that is correct. I mean, we anticipate that certain providers are not limited in terms of the number of PPSs in which they are our partner. They can be in more than one. And certainly home care agencies, particularly home care agencies that cover large geographic areas or in New York City are across multiple boroughs and maybe partner with lots of different hospitals and other types of providers across that larger geographic area, it makes absolute sense for them to be potentially a partner in multiple PPSs. That's certainly the model that we anticipate. I hope that gives you the clarity you're looking for.
Yes, thank you very much.
Great.
Your next question comes from the line of Christy Simmons. Your line is open.
Hi, I was looking for more information on the allocation of funds between the two pools and also about the IGT process, especially for PPSs that do not have a public entity provider within its system.
Right. So I think that more information is to come on the allocation between the pools. We're in active dialogue with the public hospitals themselves to try to better understand the nature of the partnerships they're looking to create. We're also talking to CMS further about that particular issue. I think what we going in initially thought some of the relationships were going to be, and I think even the public hospitals themselves thought was going to be the nature of some of the relationships, is evolving as they engage more with the community providers, providers who are in the communities that they serve. So we're trying to retain some flexibility there to make sure that we don't create some artificial constructs that sort of limit us, going forward. Because we definitely believe that public providers need to be partners with non-public providers, and based on what we're hearing, particularly in upstate, we're hearing about some pretty significant levels of partnering across large geographic areas, and in those environments in particular, is one of those things where we want to have some flexibility between the two pools, so we make sure that each of the projects is adequately funded, given the valuation that those projects are going to generate. I don't know, Greg, if you had anything more you wanted to add on that?
No, I think you've said most of it, and I think we will have quite a bit more detail. I think our main advice to the performing provider systems right now is just really focus on network formation, irrespective of public provider or private provider or safety net provider, rather, and that we will make sure that the financing takes care of itself and that we figure out an equitable way to distribute performance payments, which is our goal and CMS's goal. So right now, I think we want everybody to partner if that's making sense locally. And then we will be, working very closely to make sure that all of the performance payments balance out.
All right. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Matthew Cooper. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. This is Matthew Cooper from Albany Medical Center. A question we have is, our Medicaid population is, at the physician level, is primarily treated in our faculty practices offices. We do not operate a lot of hospital-based clinics. And we chose not to, segregate those populations from our mainstream population. The question is, if it's a non-Article 28 faculty practice operation operated by Albany Medical Center, are they considered non-participating partners at the 5% limit, or would they be rolled into our operations as participating partners?
So I think that's a good question, and I think given your structure, actually, it might make sense for us to have a direct conversation. I mean, generally speaking, the way the definition works is it looks at a provider, an individual provider, and if the question is for your primary lines of business, for that individual provider, does that provider, in a 35% of their volume, is in the primary lines of business the Medicaid population. We do know that in the case of individual physician practices, we don't actually collect data actually at that level, but that definition applies to the individual practice level if that's the structure. But the structure you describe, I think, is a little bit more complex. It's probably worth a separate offline conversation, which we'd be more than happy to engage in with Albany Med, in terms of trying to better understand your structure relative to the definition. And so we anticipate. And one of the things we're also going to be doing for the sort of the broader audience is we're going to be putting out updated documents that outlines eligibility or based on our analysis, who is in fact meets the definition across a wide array of provider types. We've been working with our OMH and OASIS and OPWDD colleagues to put together for these other types that are not out there. Also, we detected there was a data problem in our, particularly for CHAS, because the CHAS data does not include duly eligible, so that will impact CHA eligibility. So So we're going to be refreshing a couple of those charts that are out there and adding more. And then at the same time, we're also going to put out an appeal application. So if you feel that whatever data we use, which is usually cost report data coming straight from the provider, but it's the extent to which that data may not be accurate for whatever reason, and we missed something, we'll give folks an opportunity to be have their, basically go through.
This is an issue of we did qualify as a safety net hospital. Had our practice data been in there, we would have been more than qualified anyway. The issue is when we start developing our application and our plans, we may want to include our faculty practice in with maybe a discharge clinic, follow-up clinics that might require support above the 5% level. And since they're not Article 28 clinics, would they qualify as participating partners under Albany Med, or does the 5% limit kick in?
Right. So I think that, as I said, I think it's probably worth an offline conversation just to make sure we understand the nature of the relationships there. Glad to hear you are interested in participating. So happy to have that conversation.
Okay, great.
Your next question comes from the line of Lori Brown. Your line is open.
Hi. I've got a couple
Hello.
Of questions. Hi, guys. I think you may have asked this, but I'm going to ask it a different way. When there is a public hospital and a safety net provider, be that a hospital or a nursing home, et cetera, meeting the safety net criteria, how do the Medicaid members get attributed? And is there any risk at of diluting one out, you know, of canceling one or the other out in that partnership toward in vis-a-vis the methodology to value the projects?
Right. Very good question. I think that in terms of, like, I think it sort of gets to the core of for large public providers or for public providers more generally, what value does the partnership with the non-public providers bring to the table? And I think that what you're getting at is one of the values that these non-public providers bring is, in fact, attribution. So in a sense, so the case of nursing homes is a good example. While we have not put out there formal guidance in terms of how the long-term care service utilization will drive attribution, I think we've said in multiple forums that the nursing home service will be near the top of that pyramid of attribution. And we think that's logical because the vast majority of the services overall on a day-to-day basis that an individual nursing home resident receives comes directly from the nursing home. So if there's a nursing home, if their nursing home is participating in a performing provider system, that's going to have a big impact on their attribution. I think that it won't in any way dilute. In fact, what it would do is it would increase potentially the amount of attribution to a public, if the public is, let's assume, the lead and is bringing in non-public providers. I think
right.
The real benefit to that public is that it will increase, it creates an opportunity for an increase in overall project valuation.
That's helpful, and that's very clear. May I ask the second question?
Sure.
Okay. So does the lead PPS have to, and that has identified other partners, be they safety net or non-safety net partners, does that PPS have to have all of those partners working on every project that the PPS, from all the domains that the PPS has identified, or can that relationship be project specific?
So that's a good question. The answer is no. Not all the partners in the PPS have to work on all the projects.
Right.
Obviously, you know, you have projects that are focused on primary care or behavioral health or long-term care, and wouldn't make logical sense that all of the providers have to work on all the projects. Rather, what the PPS needs to figure out is after it does its health needs assessment, and it really determines what the challenges are facing the community, and particularly the Medicaid population in that community, and they build these partnerships in terms of who's going to be working together as part of the PPS. It's then the big task is, okay, this group of providers, who's going to work on which projects, and how
right.
are they going to work, providers from across the spectrum going to work together on these projects. But definitely, it's anticipated that there will be providers within a PPS who will only work on select projects that relate to for which it's appropriate for them to be involved. The one thing I would say is obviously all of the providers within the PPS should all be working towards common goals, and so should be sharing information, should be working towards particularly some of those things like the avoidable hospital use, where we feel like that's a measure, those are things where, you know, virtually everyone should be committed to doing what they can in the situations that they're in to really work hard to reduce avoidable hospital.
Thank you. And then just one more, and this is, I think, more about the data. HHC has a home care agency, as you know. They were not on the list. Might that be because their Medicaid list that had a number of Medicaid members? Does that mean that maybe their numbers in our overarching organization or attributed to the facilities? Or was that, is that going to be corrected? Someone talked about the child data.
Yeah.
Right. It could be. I mean, Greg, I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, so that does not surprise me. The data that we pulled was limited to inpatient clinic, ED, and practitioner services. So
okay.
We would not have been picking up long-term care in that those counts. And again, those sheets.
No, I think.
Yeah. No.
Are you sure? Okay.
Yeah, and if you're talking about the spreadsheets on the website and not the safety net numbers,
I think she's talking about the safety net numbers.
Are you?
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, Jason.
Yeah, she's talking about.
I'm talking.
Yeah.
About the
okay. So what you're saying is that the HHC CHA is not listed on our list that's out there with regards to which CHAs meet the safety net definition. What we will do is we'll follow back up on that. That is one of those that is being updated. Well, we can see why you aren't included, if it's just an oversight, or if for whatever reason
it wasn't in the public.
It's someplace else. Maybe it would have been pulled as part of a more of a general HHC run. But that's good for you to point that out, and we'll follow up with John Gay and his staff on that.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Melanie Schoenberg. Your line is open.
All right.
Yes, hi.
Next
thanks
question.
For your. Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Thanks for your time. Just a quick question. I know you guys had mentioned previously that there would be a valuation tool that would be up on the website, and I was wondering if you could provide a timeline for when you expected that would be. And just to clarify, that would be for, you know, punching in if I do these five projects, how much would, you know, an estimated valuation get me?
Right. So we're almost done with that tool. That is an issue that we're trying to resolve right now with CMS around projects specifically that are led by the public hospitals that we have to address, I think what we're trying to address before we put out that tool. But we anticipate putting that tool out in the not-too-distant future. But as I say, there's just one outstanding issue that we're trying to resolve. But, yes, we understand. We think that project, that tool will be very helpful to assist providers as they begin to think about the project. The one thing I would say is that, and I know there's always a rush to want to work hard on deciding which projects and how to drive up value. But I do think it's important for folks that before they get too far down the path here of committing themselves to projects is to make sure they're doing that health needs or that community needs assessment And we will also be coming out in the not-too-distant future with some further guidance on what should be included in that. And so hopefully that will be helpful, too. And whenever I get questions about the individual projects and figuring out the value of the projects, is that I think important for folks to make sure, because your application and the score you get on the application will be directly impacted by the degree to which you chose projects that reflect community need. And that's an important part. So, next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Sarah Shaporian. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you so much for this call. We actually have a question in regards to being part of multiple PPSs. And first of all, if we're able to do that and send in a letter of intent ourselves. And there's a second part to that question. If we're not able to get on any PPS as a follower, then what is the next step? Because we are interested in being part of the district project.
Right. I would discourage you from sending in a letter of intent if it's just you on behalf of one organization. As we said before, individual applicants are not eligible for participation. Just because you aren't on a letter of intent on May 15th doesn't in any way, shape, or form mean the end of the world. It actually, you'll have plenty of opportunity between now and mid-December before we really do need to lock in on who is partnering with who. So I think there's still time, and we are committed to building relationships. And if you are, I don't know what type of provider you are, or the degree to which you're providing Medicaid services, or services to Medicaid population, I should say. But assuming you are, an important Medicaid provider, it's really going to be in the interest of other providers in your area to include you, because they would be negatively impacted from an attribution standpoint if you're not included.
And I just, the letters of intent do require the lead provider to provide a contact person's name and contact information, so I would encourage you on probably the week after we receive them, we'll put them up publicly. So you should be able to look in your region and see who has submitted a letter of intent, and then you can reach out and let them know of your interest.
Yeah. And we ourselves are going to be looking at these letters of intent, and then when we say ourselves, I mean across multiple state agencies, our colleagues at OMH, OASIS, OPWDD, and then across the health department are going to be looking to see, are there providers out there important to the Medicaid population who aren't currently part of some of these potential performing provider systems? And we will take action to help to bring some of those relationships together, and certainly raising awareness on both sides, both on the potential performing provider system side about providers that they have yet to include, but also to reach out to the providers who aren't in yet to make sure they're aware of the initiative and encourage them to reach out if they haven't already.
Yes, thank you. And that does absolutely answer my second question. I guess my first question, so if we were to, we're an FQHC, 80% of our patient population is our Medicaid patients, and we're located in Brooklyn. The first part of our question was that if we were to submit a letter of intent, we would submit a letter of intent in collaboration as being the leader for the FQHC, but in collaboration with other organizations. The only way we see that happening is that we would be collaborating with other FQHCs as well as home care and whatever the case is, and if there's a hospital that does not seek to be a leader. For example, if we are our patients primarily go to a hospital that is located in Manhattan, although we are in Brooklyn. So we are actually trying to become part of their PPS as part of the thing. But what I'm trying to ask is that, so the letter of intent part, if we want it, are we able to, as an FQHC, submit a letter of intent in collaboration with other FQHCs and home care and whatever other facilities that we identify with? And the second part to that, if we do not submit a letter of intent, are we able to be on multiple letter of intents for various hospitals until a final decision is made. The reason that is because, as speaking with many hospitals, we're starting to see that they're seeing this letter of intent as just that, an intention. So meaning they can drop a practice at any time. And so we would like to be on multiple letter of intents that would serve our interests and our mission. So that's what we're trying to identify with.
Sure. So first and foremost, you're going to be very important to would-be applicants, whether you're proposing to be the lead, which you could be. There's nothing that says that the lead applicant for a performance provider system has to be a hospital. It can actually be any provider who meets the definition, and based on what you just described, which makes sense, you would be eligible as a full participant and could be the lead entity. So then the question is, you've got choices to make. What you've understood is that you've got to decide whether you want to be part and parcel of multiple performing fire systems. That is an option to you. There's nothing that stops you from being on multiple letters of intent, because we certainly see that a very likely outcome is that you will end up with certain providers in more than one PPS. I think the way you're thinking about this is very good, in the sense that you need to think about, from the patients you serve, what other providers in your community are those people utilizing? You know, what are the community-based behavioral health services that providers? What are the hospitals? What other home care providers? I think thinking about it in that way is a good way to start, because what you want is, you want to be part and parcel of those performing provider systems that match up with how the people you serve as a primary care practice, how they consume healthcare services. And we are well aware that you've got circumstances like you described, where you'll have a Brooklyn-based primary care provider who has most of its hospital use in a Manhattan-type setting. But I think it sounds, from what you're describing, you're thinking about it the right way. But there's nothing it is important to folks understand that letters of intent are non-binding. So if you're not on the letter of intent now, there's nothing, that's not going to negatively affect you in the future in any way. You could always be added. Really, you have between now and mid-December before we really have to lock down on who's partnering with who. And as you described, you're certainly welcome to submit one as a lead. But I do suggest, if you are going to submit a letter of intent as a lead, you also have to try to see to what extent is your network of providers within your PPS sufficiently broad enough to meet your needs. Is it as inclusive across the provider types to meet the goals and aspirations of the program? There's no penalty to you if you don't meet all of it all the way, but we encourage you to try to, to the extent possible by May 15th to, you are going to submit one as a lead, to try to have sufficient partners out there to show that you certainly have a capacity to get to a network that is going to meet the program's requirements.
And thank you. And I'm sorry. Actually, just a follow up to your to what you had just said, because that makes absolute sense and that clears stuff up for us. If we at this time are collaborating to be part of other organizations' PPSs, but during this time frame between now and December, we discover that it may be more beneficial to us to actually become a lead and collaborate with, our own selected team. Is it possible to become a lead after the May 15th deadline, or is the letter of intent putting our hat in as a potential leader? And after the fact, then there's no other option to be an actual leader. I'm asking.
Yeah. Nothing in the May 15th date affects who could be a lead for a performing provider system. It's really the key thing about the May 15th, and I know it makes folks a little nervous about it, but there's nothing that precludes someone from being a lead. Nothing precludes someone from participating in a performing provider system. We could end up with very different results when it comes down to the final applications. But there is nothing that, in the May 15th that locks you in or locks you out of any level of participation.
That's so helpful. Thank you so much.
Your next question comes from the line of Robin Vaughn. Your line is open.
Hi. It's funny. I was actually going to ask those questions about the letter of intent. The answer did make me feel better because the agency right now, I work at, it's the OPWDD agency that they have. So I'm feeling a little nervous because, you know, I hear a lot, even on the phone, it's like more like home care providers, a lot of hospitals. And I'm just wondering, because like on the OPWDD website, I don't, you know, I'm not really hearing anything on that, on our end, about this initiative. So I don't know if anybody else is out there that's with OPWDD or like where we stand, you know, as a day have provider. We're looking to open like a SIP program, you know, to like deal with entitlement to benefit. You know, I don't know where, you know, we really fit because a lot of the information, as you know, doesn't speak to our end. So,
right.
You know,
And so that is an issue that's been raised with us. For quite a while here in the waiver discussions, we were under the assumption that the DD system and the roughly 120,000 people who are in the Medicaid program receiving services through the DD system were going to actually be outside of the waiver and proceeding down a separate track in terms of reform. CMS, sort of later in our negotiations, felt strongly that this should be this initiative that benefits the entire Medicaid population. So hence, there's now opportunities for the DD population to be included, and DD providers, therefore, need to be included as part of performing provider systems. So I'm not surprised that there's, you know, still some confusion out there. One of the thoughts that we had is we can circle back with our OPWDD colleagues is potentially maybe to have a webinar set up to actually directly engage DD providers to raise awareness about this so that folks in the DD world have a better sense of the role they could potentially play. But, you know, absolutely, whether it's dually eligible or Medicaid-only members with developmental disabilities, we definitely think that they're the providers for that population are important partners, and we want to encourage relationships in that area. We will be actively working with OPWDD with each of the PPSs that begins to evolve out of this process to make sure that they're inclusive of the DD population. If they aren't, they're not going to get the attribution associated with those DD members, and therefore they'll get less money for the project. So it's going to be important for folks to understand that in order to get that attribution, they need to include the providers to provide services to that population.
And I would also just say, this is Greg, as a follow-up to that, that we had been asked to invite the DD providers to the behavioral health webinar that we're in the process of scheduling, and we're doing that through the associations. But as Jason mentioned, we will also schedule a special webinar just for the DD provider community as well.
Okay.
All right. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Jessica Reddo. Your line is open.
Hi. Just had a couple of questions. I'm also from the home care spectrum here, and I'm taking a look at whether or not if we want to be a lead, say we decided to do that, we cover eight counties, as I'm hearing some of the other home care providers say they, you know, have a big geographic area. Can you be a lead in one area of what you provide, and then would, from these letters of intent, would somebody at the state level say maybe these folks over here want to partner with this agency since they're in that county, even though they're not a lead? I mean, how does that work? And if we wanted to be part of more than one, which I'm hearing you say we can, is that still one letter of intent, or how does that, I mean, I guess if we decided to be the lead in more than one, I guess would be my question.
So when you, if you wish to be a lead, you must meet the eligibility criteria for being a safety net provider. You must build a network of providers that is sufficient to meet the needs of the program, meaning that underneath your, within that performing provider system, you need to have providers from across the spectrum. So hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, DD providers, community-based behavioral health, you know, you need a wide array of providers because you're not responsible for a subset of the population or a subset of services for a population. You're really responsible for meeting the holistic needs of a diverse group of Medicaid members within the geographic area to which you are committing yourself. So I think it's important for folks to understand, but when they're thinking about do I want to be a lead or not, that's a pretty big deal to be a lead. It's about serving a wide array of members in a wide array of settings and being accountable for results. And it's important for folks to understand that this is not a maintain the silo type of approach where you can say, well, I provide a specific set of services to a subset of the population and I want to be a quote lead for just those services for that subset of the population. That doesn't work here. It's really about population health management, and it's about a group of providers taking on the population that they serve today in a very, very holistic sense. So I think that's important. That said, okay. I think providers, so you could be a lead, and there's no restriction on the type of providers who can do that, but I think it's important for folks to understand that it's a wide breadth here that we're trying to bring together and meet the needs of. But that said, is that providers then need to decide, okay, maybe if I'm not going to be a lead, what's my geographic, where do I provide services, and who are my potential partners? I think those letters of intent will be helpful because what they'll show would be providers or people who want to be participating in this. They'll see who it is that's already begun discussions. And, what we're prepared to do is, if necessary, serve as marriage counselors to try to bring folks together. If necessary, those discussions don't sort of materialize on their own. We did this with the creation of health homes, a couple years ago, and it was very successful. And I say it's not just we as in the health department, it includes the other agencies as well. And we'll be all looking at these potential networks, these potential PPSs from each of our own disciplines to see, who's not part of these potential applications who needs to be, and we'll be doing outreach on our side to try to help forge some additional relationships, including what you described, which could be that we could see two PPSs in a geographic region, and it really, I think would make a lot of sense if we could try to get those two groups to come together and form a single effort, because they might potentially in that geographic area, if they actually came together and submitted a single application, they'd have a higher degree of likelihood of success.
Okay, that answers that question about the geographics, because not all of those big hospitals obviously are going to cover all the counties we're in. So.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right, next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Dwayne Schilke. Your line is open.
Hello, I'm from Cerebral Palsy Associations of New York State, so we can go back to that DD question and relate to what we're trying to do. We have a Medicare Shared Savings, ACO, with 14 DD providers operating in Article 28, plus an IPA in Queens that has joined us as an adjunctive group. The group in New York City, which is about seven agencies operating in Article 28, is looking at forming a PPS as a lead, and we're in the process of trying to figure out who we should be partnering with, and the hospital part is a little difficult for us. Even though each of us has affiliation agreements as an Article 28, with a hospital that's most likely near our health centers, that's not where the patients end up going, because our patients live in all of the boroughs, across all of the boroughs. So I just, as an example, did a sample study this morning of our Bronx people living in our residences, and not a single one of them was hospitalized at the hospital we have our affiliation agreement with. And most of them were, in this case, hospitalized at Albert Einstein, which we have no relationship with. Is there a data source where we could take our patients, we're probably talking about 15,000 beneficiaries, Medicaid beneficiaries, where we could take our patients' zip codes and match them to the catchment areas of hospital zip codes? Is there such a document that details catchment areas of hospitals? People end up in the emergency room and then subsequently hospitalized more on the basis of where they live rather than where they receive service, because the ambulance takes them to wherever the closest hospital is. So we would like to align that better because it's obviously not working now. And we don't even get information when they're in the hospital or discharge summaries and all those kind of things. We would like to strengthen our relationship with those hospitals, not only on the prevention side, but once someone is in the hospital, try to get interconnectivity, get a notice of inpatient status, a notice of discharge, a discharge summary electronically, so that we can have a better connection and manage folks' care much better. So it's really a data question. Where do I find the catchment areas of hospitals by zip codes?
Right. So we're just saying as you were finishing up there that the world you describe, which I understand is the world that is exactly the problem we're trying to solve, which is a very siloed delivery system for a very vulnerable population that needs this kind of initiative more than as much as anyone, which is in the sense that you've got hospitals that are not connected to other providers, no communication, no information sharing, and what we're trying to accomplish with the PPS is to achieve a much higher degree of coordination, collaboration between providers and getting that information flowing, and getting providers working together more holistically to meet the needs of the population that they serve. And so I think in as to your data question, I mean, the key thing is that the data, in essence, that you're looking for, I think, exists in the sense that, we can work with you in the sense of the Medicaid members that you serve. We potentially could do some analysis to give you a sense of what hospitals they're using, because that should be coming through in the Medicaid claims data, either through the encounter data we get from managed care plans or on the fee-for-service data that we get, that we could give you a sense for the members you're proposing to serve, who those members are using from a hospital care standpoint. And I think what you're going at, which is a very good way to think about this, which is from a partnering standpoint, you really want to make sure you're partnering with the providers who provide care to the people you serve on a daily basis. And you have to think about, in essence, these are healthcare consumers, they consume healthcare, and when you think about who needs to be partnering, it's really the people who are each touching that same individual. Now, that's not always perfect and easy to do, but I think the goal should be, to the max degree we can, is sort of align these PPSs around the sort of natural utilization patterns of the Medicaid population. I think that should be the goal. So, Greg, I don't know if you have any further thoughts on that.
Yeah, so we are, number one, we can ask that specific question kind of on an all-payer basis of our colleagues in the Office of Health Systems Management to see what might be available. You know, we know the catchment areas of New York City hospitals are very complex things. People,
some of lines each other.
but we will see what is immediately available. We are developing on the Medicaid side a set of tools that would allow eventually folks to make collections of their own patients if they are currently billing Medicaid, and then see where else they go for services on a non-personal health information basis, just on an aggregate basis. And those capabilities will be coming on board sometime in June. But in the meantime, as a take back here, we will just see if there's any existing tools on hospital catchment areas that may help you in the shorter term.
Okay, great. It's certainly a goal of the ACO to develop those relationships that Jason was just talking about. And it's one of our major focuses is to get the connectivity in place between all the providers so you can collaborate. So on the Medicare
you're
side,
asking.
We are starting to see some Medicare data that's telling us some very interesting things. We don't have a very high hospitalization rate compared to our ER visits. Our ER visits are high, and those can probably be managed significantly better because it's the nature of the DD service system that triggers people going to the ER when they don't necessarily need to clinically. So that's another thing we're addressing within the ACO, is how to do new workflows to keep people away from the emergency room by diverting to urgent cares or giving triage personnel access to live EHR data so that they could triage in a better way. So all of this stuff aligns in DSRIP with exactly what we're doing in the ACO. So we see it as a perfect opportunity. We want to take advantage of as much of it as we can. So we're expecting to have about 8 or 9 DD agencies come together as a primary care network in New York City and be the lead in the PPS, and then connect up with the long-term care providers, home health agencies. We already have pharmacy, radiology, and labs already in place, and any other providers that would be able to support folks from inappropriately using emergency rooms. So that's our goal, and that's probably how we're going to present it. But we're short of data to try to do good analysis of who to connect with.
All right, well, thanks. Let's move on so we can keep getting more questions.
Your next question comes from the line of Robert Blake. Your line is open.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. I guess along the line of the 5% funding rule and the eligibility to participate in DSRIP, we have some real concerns on how to bring in home care and also physicians. So I just wanted to ask for clarification. If a home care agency or a physician practice does not meet eligibility to participate as a DSRIP provider, are they outright prohibited from working with a PPS collaboration, or can they participate and only receive up to 5% of DSRIP funds, or can they simply participate, bill Medicaid? And I guess the second question to that is, over time, if we're working with a home health agency and in year 2 or 3 of DSRIP, they do in fact qualify based on their Medicaid share to be a DSRIP provider, can they then receive DSRIP funding?
Sure. So 5% cap. The 5% cap applies. First off, can non-qualifying providers, those who don't meet the safety net definition, be part and parcel of a PPS? The answer is yes. And we want to encourage that because we think that those providers are vital partners and should be actively involved in the PPS in terms of trying to achieve the success of each PPS. So what does that, what does their involvement mean? Well, that involvement means that those providers who are non-qualifying, that in aggregate they cannot receive more than 5% of total dollars through the district program. That said, we have also an option, and there's an exception clause here where if we have a provider who's really essential to the success of the district program, and it's important that that provider be a full participant and not limited to be part of that 5% pool, then you should explore when we make it available the opportunity for that provider to potentially go through that exceptions process and be determined to be a full participant. Your second question relates to what happens into the future, utilization of Medicaid services changes over time. That issue has been raised several times. It's something we still need to work through with regards to CMS. CMS has had generally a position, which I think we understand and have supported, which is we want to create some stability here for performing providers within the system. In the sense that we want to have some assurances about project valuation. That's why it's locked in year one and really intended to nearly not be changed unless there's extraordinary circumstance. We also want to lock in the PPS network starting in year one and keep all those providers working together over a five-year period. So at this point, our sort of default position is unless there's some extraordinary reason for changing that, that we'd like to sort of maintain that tradition of locking it in and staying there. Now we know full well that you know Medicaid utilization patterns change and the share of Medicaid could go up or could go down. I think that we have an opportunity at the midpoint, sort of in year 3 of the waiver period, to potentially take a look at some of these issues again. But I don't want to create an expectation that we're going to be able to make modifications here once we get past when we lock in on who the PPSs are at the end of year zero and start that process in year one.
Thank you. I have a second question. I know you said earlier that you were going to give more guidance on what is required for the community health needs assessment. As I review the projects in the project toolkit, I get the sense that you're looking for a community assessment that goes beyond what might be a traditional morbidity, mortality trends, which are of course crucial, but you're also looking to assess the healthcare infrastructure. How many facilities are there? How many clinical staff are there? So you can draw a line and validate each PPS picking their project. Is that fair to say?
Yes, and what I think you'll be seeing in the not-too-distant future is some guidance that will give you a flavor for what we're looking for in that health community needs assessment. That says, you know, there's been some community needs assessments that have done. Counties, local health departments have been doing some of them. Local hospitals are required to do them. And some of the data that's included in some of those is going to be very helpful, but there's also going to be some requirements that are specifically targeted at requirements in districts. So we do anticipate there's going to be some additional work here above and beyond what's already been done, but that's why we felt it was important to get some feedback out to you in the near future in terms of what those requirements are.
Okay, just one more real quick one. Concerning behavioral programs, are state OMH facilities eligible to participate in BizRIP?
You mean in terms of, as you know, the state, if you're regulated by OMH, or you mean state?
No. In terms of being part of a PPS, can an OMH facility be part of a PPS?
So the answer to that is that they could be part of the network, but given the nature of the fact that they're providing services that are not Medicaid eligible services, IMD type services, they're not going to qualify under the safety net definition. So they would be restricted within the 5% cap. But definitely, if it makes sense for them to be part of a PPS network. There's nothing that stops them. In fact, we would want to encourage them from participating.
Thank you so much.
How do we go on? Thanks. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Shannon Williams. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Shannon McWilliam. I'm asking a question on behalf of Dr. Manjanath. He was sitting in this meeting with me, and he posed whether or not there would be any consideration to mandate an inclusion of pediatric measures as a requirement?
There are pediatric measures. In fact, in the avoidable hospital use measures, you'll see that there are pediatric measures. So we absolutely see that children, children on Medicaid, absolutely we anticipate them being part of the initiative. So I think what you're suggesting, including avoidable hospital use amongst children, is already included and is going to be a mandatory measure because it applies across Domain 2 projects, of which each PPS is required to choose two. And therefore, every PPS will be required to work on reductions in avoidable hospital use for children. So that's definitely part and parcel of the current proposal.
Okay, thank
you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Angela Diaz. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I want to know if you will accept two applications as lead from the same institution, and if so, can one of them be for adolescent and young adults citywide?
So we need an entity to be a lead entity in the sense that somebody that we can hold accountable as an organization, someone who's potentially capable of accepting planning grant and eventually district funds. So we're going to need some single entity from an accountability standpoint. That said, one of the things that we have opened the door to is the possibility that organizations could come together and form a new corporate structure that could serve as the lead entity. So that is a possibility, because we know one of the issues is providers sort of getting around agreement around who is going to be the lead and the unwillingness to sort of allow one sort of first among equals. So we are open to this, this alternative corporate structure. We saw that evolve as part of Health Home. So we are going to do that. We have to circle back a little bit with CMS and may have to use one of the exception clauses in order to allow them to be the lead because of the nature of the safety net definition. But it is something that's been raised with us multiple times, and so that is a possibility. In terms of like a citywide specialized population, we're not closing the door to it, but I just think that you'll have some significant challenges in terms of building a network that is capable of meeting the needs of the population on a citywide basis. You know, that would imply that you potentially need to have virtually all the hospitals in the network. That may be challenging. A PPS that providers participating in more than one PPS can be a challenge in the sense that that means they got a lot of different collaborations they need to stay engaged in. And, you know, we're trying to fundamentally change the structure of relationships here in care delivery. So I would be nervous about the ability of, you know, a hospital or some of the other provider types, clinics, to try to partner with many sort of programs that specialize only in a particular population. Because if you take a step back and look at DSHRF, it's really not so much about specializing in a subset of the Medicaid population. It's really looking at across an entire the entire Medicaid population and designing solutions to address the needs of those subpopulations, but all within the context of a single performing provider system. And so that's the general structure. I'm not saying it can, what you suggest can't be 100% can't be done, but I just think there's going to be some significant barriers to being able to come together around a PPS that actually will meet all the requirements of the program. All right. So, okay. Oh, so for the operator, may I ask how many people are currently in the queue?
You have approximately 20 people queued up for questions.
All right. So with the 20 people on the queue, since we have 40 minutes, I'm just going to try to take it a little bit quicker so hopefully we can get to everybody because we do have a hard stop here at 4 o'clock. So why don't we take the next question?
Your next question comes from the line of Elizabeth Cormis. Your line is open.
Yes, I have two questions. One is there was no definition of supportive housing in the glossary, and would supportive housing include ALPS and ALRs?
Good question. I think that we should take that back and take a look, because I think you're right. There was no definition in the glossary on supportive housing, and that's a very good point. That's good feedback. We'll take that back and hopefully update the glossary to reflect it. We are pushing the envelope here on the issue of supportive housing. CMS has sort of been hesitant to want to fund with Medicaid dollars housing programs. But as you'll see, you know, in some of this, we've been trying to include in some of these projects because we feel so strongly about it. Important also to point out, CMS has not officially signed off on all the elements of the toolkit. So we'll see just to see whether they raise any further objections about those housing components, particularly the nursing medical home program and a couple of other projects. The nursing home medical village project. But we'll look to see if we can't get a definition for you. What's your next question?
Well, also on that question, you know, the idea that assisted living and particularly ALPS are a crucial way to keep people out of the nursing homes, and they have the same kind of episodes where people end up in the ER, and providing additional services such as maybe a physician or PA could prevent readmission. That's why, you know, we were asking that.
Sure. ALPS,
question is, can for-profit entities be participate as partners in a PPS, given that, you know, some of the projects relate to nursing homes, et cetera, and in many markets there are significant players that are for-profits?
Yes, there is no limit on participation, for-profit versus non-profit. So, yes, for-profit providers can participate, assuming they meet the safety net definition. And, yes, ALF providers, any provider that meets the Medicaid safety net definition can be a full participant, and even those who don't can still be part of the initiative, but within the 5% cap. So, you know, we're interested, as we say, and, you know, even including providers who don't provide Medicaid services at all, community-based organizations be included as active participants in the initiative.
Thank you.
All right. So let's go to the next. Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Kurt McGuard. Your line is open.
No, Kurt? All right. Why don't we go on to the next question?
Your next question comes from the line of Belkis Garcia. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm with the Legal Aid Society, and my question is about case management in DSRIP from a client's recipient consumer perspective. The way our clients report, the experience that they report currently is that they, you know, go to their provider who recommends a service or supply or some type of care. If there's some holdup or barrier, either a denial from the plan or some procedural administrative hold up, what they typically do, in my experience, is they talk to their provider who gives them as much time and attention as they're able to do on this issue, and then the consumer calls either member services, or if they have an appointed case manager, they call that person. And I'm trying to figure out or seek some clarity on how DOH envisions case management working under this model, and how will that be communicated, how will that change be communicated to consumers?
Right. Okay. So case management, very good question. So case management, the extent to which for the members who currently have are involved in active case management, many of those case management programs have been merged under the health home, or we used to call it, we always call them targeted case management, COBRA case management, those types of activities, those merging now into health homes within that construct. But that relationship between a case manager and a Medicaid member, very important, and we will maintain it. And how are we going to do that is that they are going to be at the top of the attribution pinnacle. And so the idea is whichever case manager that they have, that whichever case manager is part of a health home, that relationship will be maintained. And the goal here is that we think that, you know, that level of care coordination is essential, and we want to maintain it. So there really should be no impact on that. Then the question then becomes, okay, so you had, there's a subset of population who's not in case management but needs navigational assistance. If they're health home eligible, the idea is that they'll continue to work in health homes, and it's important that health homes are part and parcel of these performing provider systems. It's a case management infrastructure we built, and we are increasing the number of people in it, and so it's a way for us to extend organized, accountable case management to a larger population. That said, there's still a further a situation with regards to Medicaid members who don't meet the health home's definition of eligibility. So what happens for that population within a performance provider system? Certainly the goal here and the public, the PBS are held accountable for, is to try to make sure that the patient experience, the navigation, is as seamless and smooth for those members as is possible. And so one of the, and you'll see this, is that there's actually an explicit strategy in Domain 2 around creating a new case management approach, building off of health homes, where you actually will see additional case management resources funded through the waiver for these PPSs to actually extend case management to an even larger population of people that have access to it today. I think it's really important that people who have hard times navigating, who have lots of complex needs and need help, that we would extend that to the max degree possible. The last subset, and you will always have this, are populations who don't necessarily need active case management on a daily basis, but will still have questions about how they access services. The goal should be that the primary care providers that are part of these PPSs should be at the same table and engaged with the broader array of providers that are part of that PPS. And that level of engagement should help those patient-centered medical homes, for instance, help patients that they serve on a daily basis navigate and access the more comprehensive, the more complex services that they need. They need specialty care, they need other types of services that really see that primary care physician as vital to all of that. And it's going to be up to the PPSs, if they want to be successful, to find ways to make sure that all those providers are actively working together. So hopefully what will happen as a result of this is the patient experience will be better in the sense that either they'll be in a new case management program that they're not in today, or that their primary care physician, now engaged as part of one of these PPSs, will have more opportunity to effectively help that patient navigate the complex system. Certainly what we're trying to achieve by integrated care is that you actually have providers working together, collectively accountable for improved results, and it's going to be essential that these members of the PPS are working together and achieving that result.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Lynn Quintos. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking this question. We do not qualify as a safety net provider. However, we are very interested to apply as a full participant under your exception criteria. Can you elaborate on this exception criteria and how we can help position ourselves to enhance our application to be successful as a full participant?
I suggest you look at the terms and conditions of the waiver that are included on the website. It really lays out very clearly what the exception criteria are, and take a look at that. More information to come in terms of the application process and how we structure that. But I do think in the meantime, it's important for you to think about how you can participate and partner with other providers in your area. Obviously, you can express your interest and your intention to want to, you know, go through one of these exception clauses to potentially allow you to more fully participate, meaning you won't be limited to that 5% cap. But I think it's a part and parcel that, you know, you're going to have to show that you're proposing to be part of one or more PPSs and that you're essential to that PPS's success. And that's going to be key. So it's important for you to be an active participant in a PPS.
And the second
question.
Yeah, we're a participant of the Hospital Medical Home Demonstration Project. Under that, we have a patient-centered medical home which serves majority Medicaid population. Can we leverage on that success and plan another project with the same population target?
Could you repeat the question one more time?
Okay, we are a recipient of the Hospital Medical Home Demonstration Project grant from the Department of Health. So under that, we operate a patient-centered medical home, which serves majority Medicaid recipients. And are we able to apply to design a project around the same population of patients, different projects through district?
Sure.
Our rules here are important. So the first thing is you can definitely design other interventions, other evidence-based strategies around that same population. We would expect that to happen. That's sort of core to this, that you would be doing more with that same population. You can also leverage your patient-centered medical home strategy to bring in more patients. We just cannot just use DSHRP resources to fund something that's already operational for the same patients with the same scope and intensity of services. So, but your direct question about being able to do other strategies and other interventions with that same population of patient-centered medical home, absolutely, that's what we expect. That's what we're trying to do here with DSHRP.
Yeah, in fact, I think what you'll see is when you look at all of the different primary care projects that are included, there's absolutely an expectation that those primary care practices participate in DSHRP will meet patient-centered medical home level 3 accreditation through NCQA. And with when the state health innovation plan comes out with clear guidance in terms of what the advanced model for primary care is, then we're also going to expect that the practices that are participating, receiving funds through the district, will achieve what will in essence be even a higher level of effectiveness. So, but as a provider of primary care services who serves the Medicaid population today, I think you're well positioned as and a very logical partner and actually a very valuable partner to perform provider systems in your area. All right, next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Rebecca Logan. Your line is open.
Hi, I was just trying to find some information about the kind of performance data that was similar to what was provided for inpatient, emergency room, and outpatient, but for the care management providers. If we could have a listing of where those Medicaid patients are kind of being followed for care management.
That's a great question, and we will take that back. We hadn't had a specific run planned actually on care management, so it's a very good suggestion, and we'll take that back and work on it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's important for folks to understand who's doing the care management type services in communities across the state. I mean, at the very least, we can put out there like our health homes and our health home enrollment by health home by geography. I mean, that in and of itself, Greg, don't you think would probably be really helpful?
We could do health home and targeted case management for the DD population, et cetera. So we could definitely put something together pretty quickly and get the care management set of workbooks up.
Good. That's a very good suggestion.
Thank you.
All right. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Tom McCarroll. Your line is open.
Thank you. This is Tom McCarroll from St. Peter's Health Partners. For a hospital component of a PPS, the 24/7 emergency department infrastructure is obviously going to need to be maintained, even if that PPS is successful in diverting members not actually requiring ED services to provider partners. Is DSRIP funding going to be made available to support the maintenance of that ED, reflecting those lower ED volumes?
Good question. So as we reduce avoidable hospital use and we increase utilization in other settings, primary care, community-based behavioral health, in essence, rebalancing the delivery system in ways that are much more in tune with the long-term health and well-being of the Medicaid population, is there going to be a revenue loss as a result of that change, particularly for hospitals? You could extend that to nursing homes, too, if the extent to which these efforts are leading to fewer people being in need of nursing care, 24-hour nursing care. And so, yes, there are potentially going to be real loss of revenue, and absolutely we anticipate that dollars payments to PPSs can be used directly to offset revenue loss at these institutions. Now, the thing I would say about this is that this waiver is going to be in place for 5 years. And so it's important over that five-year period for the providers in that system to figure out what is the sustainable path for them as a collective body. Now, we are committed to making sure that the payment system that you see and experience from Medicaid when you come out the back end of the waiver process will be better aligned with the kind of collaboration that you're achieving as part of a PPS. What I mean by that is we expect that the payment system you will feel and see will be one in which you'll be able to receive a bundle payment, a subcapitation payment, a performance-based payment, from payers, from the Medicaid managed care plans, and that as a result of that, that will give you flexibility so that in aggregate, you can continue to meet the needs, including maintaining an emergency room in the community that meets the needs of the population, even though you are seeing less Medicaid volume in that emergency room. That said, I think if you think about the configuration of services in your community, you may need to think about, and I'm not saying the emergency room is the right setting to do this, but you need to think about whether or not you need to reconfigure the services that you offer and literally take down capacity in certain areas and increase capacity in other areas. And there's clearly some projects that are targeted at doing just that. The Medical Village projects are actually very much about reconfiguring the delivery system to better match the needs of the community. And particularly the hospital Medical Village project is about taking down inpatient capacity and replacing it with other services that the community needs and using those waiver dollars to transition from the current payment or current model to the new model and address some of that revenue loss. So definitely that's been a challenge I know for hospitals is that if you want to participate and collaborate, use a direct revenue loss, there's no way to offset that revenue loss. The waiver changes that dynamic.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I'm wondering, you've mentioned on a couple of occasions the need to meet the holistic needs of members. And I wonder, would a PPS be accountable, for instance, for avoidable hospitalizations related to a Domain 3 clinical area that's not part of the PPS identified projects?
So important point is that you are accountable for reductions in avoidable hospital use for the population that you serve as a PPS. And the key thing is you need to select projects that help you be successful in achieving those metrics. Those avoidable hospital use metrics apply across all projects. Everyone's held accountable for them. And is the behavioral health population important to reducing avoidable hospital use? And the answer is absolutely yes. But regardless of which other projects you select, those measures of avoidable hospital use apply to the entire population you're serving, and it's important to know that particularly in years 4 and 5 of the waiver period, most of the money that you're going to be receiving through this initiative is going to be driven by your performance in that area.
Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Joanne McNamara. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking the time to answer these questions this afternoon. I'm calling from the William F. Ryan Community Health Center, and we're an FQHC in New York City. And we have a site, the Ryan Chelsea Clinton Center in Midtown Manhattan, that is a 330 grant subrecipient of ours, who has a separate EIN and bill under a separate NPI. And we, by that I mean Ryan, we were listed on the provider data list that was published by the state, but I noticed that the subrecipient site, Ryan Chelsea Clinton, was not. And I was wondering if the reason for that, them not being included, were that they were rolled up with us possibly, or is it more likely that they were omitted from the list?
That's probably more likely is that they were rolled up, but we will check back with John Gay and his staff.
Well, we should again clarify if we're talking about the safety net list or the salient workbooks on the website.
On the salient workbooks.
Yeah, so on the salient workbooks, we did roll people up to entity ID. So if your entity ID encompasses multiple NPIs and MMIS members, then it would be reported all together.
Okay. All right, thank you so much.
Your next question comes from
Operator, just a quick question. How many people do we have in the queue?
There's approximately 14 people.
All right, so we got to keep moving along here. We got 20 minutes to go and 14 people.
Lightning round.
Your next question comes from the line of Melissa Wendland. Your line is open.
Thank you. My question's been answered.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Carrie Brown. Your line is open.
Hi. Thank you for taking the time to answer questions this afternoon. My question is actually in regards to the design grant proposal, the application that came out. And I'm curious because it requires declaration of projects. And I guess I'm confused by that because I thought the community needs assessment was supposed to help you decide what your projects could be. So I guess I'm just curious, are you locked into those projects once you pick them? And if so, I guess, you know, my concern would be, again, it's required before the community needs assessment's even done, as well as before your performing provider system's even completely formed. And so then people would not have a voice at the table potentially.
I appreciate you raising this question. It has come up in a couple of different settings. It was actually something we debated internally. In no way, shape, or form, whatever you submit in the design grant application locks you into a particular set of projects. What you described is accurate. Our desire is to have you do the community needs assessment, and then, based on that needs assessment, select the project. That said, the main reason for us requesting this information was that we're interested, to the extent to which providers had already done some sort of needs assessment, had already had access and on hand some data that would assist them in sort of understanding what the community needs might be, to give us an early look at what kind of projects that were providers were at least thinking about. The reason why that's helpful to us is that we're going to be procuring some resources in order to provide technical assistance to would-be applicants. And but the issue is that unless we have some sense of what project people at least are considering at this point, it would be hard for us to determine what types of consulting resources or other types of resources would be most helpful. And we didn't want to sort of just take a shot in the dark and in terms of, you know, which types of things that people might be interested in. There's obviously quite a few projects out there. So, but I want to be clear and is that people should not feel in any way, shape, or form that they're obligated, locked in any way to the projects that they mentioned. Absolutely, we want them to do that comprehensive needs assessment, and then they should finalize the projects based on what that community needs assessment says.
Great.
And I will say this, I'll say this in follow-up to that. We have seen some developing PPSs that have actually already gone and looked at the data that we've got up on the website now. They've organized that data to figure out where their catchment area that they're discussing, that where the providers are discussing, ranking from highest to lowest, the kinds of performance measures that they're doing poorly in. And they've already mapped that back to our Attachment J project list and created a set of higher priority projects for consideration based on the data that's out there. So that very good start that we know some PPSs have already had, I think could be reflected in that preliminary application. But as Jason said, it would be preliminary and it would be certainly subject to the more in-depth review and the more current data that will be coming available.
All right. Let's go to the next question.
Your next question comes from a participant whose information was not provided. Caller, please state your first and last name. Your line is open.
I guess we don't have that person. So why don't we move on to the next question?
Your next question comes from the line of Patricia Belair. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. I have a question concerning the LOI and the list of partners. We have several programs that are federally qualified health centers that operate under multiple sites. In listing them, do we just list the parent organization or do we list each site individually by address?
I think either would probably be acceptable at this point, although I think that one of the things we've heard is that particularly in some of the more rural areas, you're going to have federally qualified health centers that are sort of spread over a wide geographic. They're sort of within one governance structure, but they've got multiple sites, and it will make sense to have, you know, potentially have one site and one PPS, another site and another PPS. But I think the degree to which you can be as sort of inclusive and as accurate as you possibly can, I think that would be helpful to us. But if at this point all you can do is submit it under the parent, I think that would be acceptable as well.
Would we, as a follow-up to that, as a hospital, we have obviously Article 28 ambulatory care DOH programs, but we also operate under some OMH programs and OASIS. Do we list those programs separately as well?
In the sense that they're providers, yes, I would list them separately.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Barbara Crozier. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks so much for doing this. Also, I really appreciate the offer earlier on to look at or do a call with OPWDD providers, because I think there's a lot of interest out there, but we're, I think at least speaking for myself and the CP affiliates, we feel kind of a little late in getting into the whole PPS network. Earlier on, you gave the impression that you were no longer moving forward with the 1915 BC waiver, and that everyone was going to move into the 1115.
I should clarify. Let me clarify that. We are moving forward with the BC. We are moving forward with the creation of DISCOs. We're moving forward, continuing to move forward with our move to managed care. That said, from a provider system transformational standpoint, we are going to include DD providers and the DD population within that construct. So we are not, and I want to make that clear, not ceasing our move on the 1915 BC. We're still moving forward on that. I know there's issues around if we need to the types of DISCOs we need to launch, but we definitely are moving forward with DISCOs as a strategy, and we anticipate that DISCOs will be contracting with PPSs as part of their strategy as the PPSs grow, and we're talking, you know, four or five years from now, when the PPSs are ready to actually contract with managed care organizations. So we anticipate that DISCOs will be contracting with the same kinds of entities that we're building through the waiver.
So we're doing it all.
We're doing it all. That's the goal here.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of a participant whose information has not been transcribed. Caller, please state your first and last name. Your line is open.
All right, no question. All right, next.
Your next question comes from the line of Margie Quayle. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. Thank you. Are you aware of any organizations that have started talking about in the Hudson Valley area planning to join together with some of the community hospitals to form a PPS?
There are active conversations going on all across the state. And that's what I'm saying is that I think what will be really helpful is on May 15th when we get those letters of intent and we post those to the web, that will give you a very good flavor of who it is that's thinking about this, working on this. And I think that will be a good opportunity for folks to really see who they need to partner with. But that's, you know, only a little over a week away. So I think that will be our first real opportunity to actually do a sort of a polling, I guess, of who is out there and who is interested. That's the way we sort of see these non-binding letters of intent, is to get that early look, not only for ourselves, but for all of you who are thinking about potentially partnering with PPS.
Because you have said several times that you don't feel that individual applicants are eligible for participation, even if we were to file an exception. So I'm thinking that probably is not the way we can go, although I wasn't exactly sure whether it would work or not.
An individual provider cannot be a performing provider system. They will not meet the eligibility requirement. A performing provider system, which is what these applicants are, is they have to include a wide array of providers that cut across the entire spectrum, as we said, hospitals, nursing homes, home care, clinics, you know, DD providers, behavioral health, the full array. So it's important that as a single provider, you look to see who it is that's beginning to build these and start thinking about who you can contact. And as we mentioned earlier, those letters of intent that come in will identify who the lead is and have contact information. So you'll have a number and name of someone to call to express interest in potentially joining one of these performing provider systems that is in its early stages of emerging.
Okay, thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Ann Corrigan. Your line is open.
Hi, this is a follow-up. Will the state be providing us with hospital and community-specific data on the avoidable emergency room visits? And if so, when?
Those some preliminary data will be coming available very soon. We're working on getting that up in the coming days. Actually, I believe we have some data up now on the PQIs, and PPRs are coming quickly. The PPVs on the emergency room side will lag a bit because we have those are being developed a little bit later. But the Medicaid specific PQIs and PPRs should be up very, very shortly.
Thank you.
And there's links right off the DSHRP website to all the performance information. Some of those tables will be linked to the OpenNewYork.gov site, which will provide filterable tables so you can look at it by hospital, by zip code, et cetera. And then in June, the end of June, we expect to have some dashboards available on the same site that will allow you to interact in an even more sophisticated way with the preventable data and other data.
Right, and I encourage you to follow, and if you're not already on our email, MRT email listserv, it's really a great resource. Each time we post links to the web, we'll be communicating out by listserv to let folks know what the latest postings are. All right, next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Kurt Magard. Your line is open.
Yes, hello. I wanted to know whether or not, I know it would be advantageous for PPS to have a public hospital in their PPS system as a partner. Is it required that we have a public hospital in our PPS?
No, it is not required that you have a public hospital in your PPS. It really is up to the providers to try to see who the logical partners are, but there is no requirement around having a public hospital in your network.
Okay, thank you. And as a follow-up to that, how does the hospital benefit from the reduction of hospitalizations? How does that impact on their bottom line? And why would they become an active stakeholder in this entire proposition?
Right. So the reductions in avoidable hospital use, yes, those reductions potentially create some sort of a revenue loss for the hospital. And depending on the nature of that hospital and its percent that's associated with Medicaid may require, could very well likely require, a modification in that facility. There are, I think, in the long run, significant benefits to hospital participation. What do hospitals potentially get out of this? Well, first and foremost, they can benefit from funds from the program that you otherwise would not have access to, particularly funds that could help offset some of that revenue loss throughout the waiver period. If you, for instance, don't participate, but others and providers in your community do, it's quite possible that they'll be working very hard to reduce avoidable hospital use inside your building, but you will have no way to capture any of the revenue from that initiative, and therefore, having no way to offset the loss of revenue that you'd be incurring. So I think it's important to be part of the discussion, part of the active effort, and then also potentially benefit from the broader array of resources that are coming to the table. I mean, we're bringing capital dollars to the table in the form of state funding. We're bringing regulatory relief in the sense that we have statutory authority allows the commissioners of various agencies to waive regulations that impede integration. And also, the latest thing that we're working on right now is the inclusion of the ability to apply for a certificate of public advantage, which will allow providers to gain some antitrust protections when it comes to working together across communities. So I think in the long run, there's a lot of opportunities here. I would also say that our view of the future is that payers from across the board, not just Medicaid, but Medicare is already engaged in this, and the commercial payers will also be engaged in this, in generally in efforts to reduce avoidable hospital use. And I think that what the waiver does is it gives us an opportunity to bring all these tools to the table to reconfigure the delivery systems that in ways that not only reduce the hospital use, but creates a sustainable system well in the future. We need hospitals to be available in communities across the state. We need them to be vital and vibrant well into the future, but we want them to be part of these integrated systems of care, working together with providers across the community. So I think there's plenty of value from the perspective of the hospital.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Diane Bacor. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking this question. If an organization wants to apply as a disparate provider under the vital access provider exception, in the letter of intent, how much justification do you have to supply to validate your request to be a vital access provider?
So are you saying is that in terms of meeting one of the exceptions, or that you disagree with the data and you believe you already meet the criteria?
To be the exception.
Okay, that's right, the exception. All right. In terms of the exception, we will, as I say, come out with more information in terms of you should look at the terms and conditions, you should look at what the criteria are, but we will be coming out with more information on this and an explicit process. But I think it's important, and you'll see that in those criteria, how you as a provider relate to the relative success of the PPS is important. And I think that's a key thing that you need to think about, and it's going to be, so it's, you know, applying sort of in isolation outside of the PPS construct, not all that helpful. It's really you have to think about, you know, if, as a result of your inclusion in this PPS or more than one PPS, why is it essential that you be a full participant and therefore should be granted one of these exceptions?
And I think
that should be included in the letter of intent.
I think you should just indicate that you plan to apply for the exception process, and if you wanted to say because of this piece, like, for example, you're a health home provider, or because we believe we are the vital provider in this area, but you don't need to go through the process. The process
right.
that Jason explained is what you will do to actually get through and be approved.
Okay. Thank you
but
very much.
Yeah.
All right. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Lori Brown. Your line is open.
It's Lorraine Brown, and many of my questions are answered, but whomever the guy was from cerebral palsy, if he wants to call me, please do, from HHC. I don't know if he's still on.
We're building PPSs on the call.
That's great, Lorraine. Thanks for mentioning that. All right, next up, how many questions do we have? How many questioners do we have left?
There are two questions left.
All right, let's see if we can get two down. We've got 6 minutes. All right.
Okay. Your next question comes from the line of a participant whose information was not provided. Please state your first and last name. Your line is open.
No. All right, last question.
And the last question comes from the line of a participant whose information was not provided. Go ahead and state your first and last name. Your line is open.
All right. Well, good news is we exhausted all the questions in our two-hour period of time. I hope folks found this helpful. This is the second time we've done an operator-assisted call. It's not the cheapest way for us to communicate with the broader audience, but we think that, as we traveled across the state, we know there's lots of questions out there, and we just felt that giving folks an opportunity to call in and ask the question directly was going to be helpful. As you can see, or I think we see certainly from the breadth of the questions that we've been getting, people have been thinking long and hard about this and have been doing a lot of their own analysis and have already been in discussions. And it's good to see that folks are beginning to really deepen their knowledge of this new program, and there's a lot of information out there, and I'm glad to have had this opportunity today. This is certainly not the last opportunity for us. We will be coming out with additional webinars in the near future. We might very well come out with some additional whiteboard videos. If folks haven't had a chance, go to our website, particularly on the safety net definition. You might find that presentation helpful. But our goal here is to try to do everything in our power to provide information to all of you and help you, because that's the key thing here, is that we really do want really good applications coming in December from performance provider systems. This is not a traditional competition in the sense that we put out a procurement document or a request for proposals and then you send back into us, and then we evaluate those and make decisions, and some people win and some people lose. Really what we want is we want providers and communities to come together, form very strong, lasting relationships, We want each and every one of those proposals to be strong, to meet the requirements, to be approved, and for us to be able to launch into the first year of this initiative with an exciting array of performance provider systems who are really committed to each other, within the PPS to each other, as well as to the Medicaid population that they serve, that they're going to work really, really hard to try to improve the health and well-being of that population. So lots more to do, and we remain committed. Please stay in touch. Follow us on the MRT listserv. Stay tuned for more documents, more data, more information coming out from us, as well as additional opportunities to engage us in the days and weeks to come. So thank you again very much. Thank you, operator, and I think that's the end of this call for today.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.